This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What if the Federal Reserve had a meeting and nothing happened? Yes, indeed, history does repeat itself. Also on the broadcast today, two true stories of hitting the jackpot and the economy in beer, just the way I like it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, August the 1st. Good as always to have you with us. And with the caveat that it is now officially August, that is the month that news takes a holiday, we will begin today with a brief item about the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. It met. That's it. It met. That's the whole smash. No changes to interest rates, no new stimulus, anything. Said they're going to wait and see what the September data brings before they do anything, if they do anything at all. So there's that. On a somewhat brighter note, there's Detroit. This being the first of the month, we got car sales figures today. Chrysler is the standout, had its best July in 5 years. And this is really a story of changing fortunes, because not so long ago, it was the Italian automaker Fiat and Uncle Sam, of course, riding to Chrysler's rescue. Now, sales are up 13% from a year ago. But as with so many things in the global economy at the moment, Europe is the weak spot. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
It was a bad case of deja vu for the head of Fiat and Chrysler, Sergio Marchionne, as he took questions during a conference call with analysts. He was reliving the stagnation of the auto market on a different continent.
The European market is now heading for a fifth straight year of decline, so we're all staring at what I consider to be irrefutable evidence of market decay.
Marchionne is essentially turning to a page from Chrysler's comeback playbook, the one Clint Eastwood read from during the Super Bowl.
The people of Detroit know a little something about this. They almost lost everything. But we all pulled together. Now Motor City is fighting again.
Chrysler's slogan, of course, has been imported from Detroit. And while that may sound exotic to a U.S. audience, the focus on car buyers here at home brought some criticism from industry analysts like Rebecca Lindland at IHS Global.
They were so dependent upon North America for all their sales. And ironically, that's actually probably what's saving them right now, because they're really shielded from the chaos of Europe.
So much so that Marchionne says for the next few years, he intends to shift his focus, adding to manufacturing shifts at Chrysler, even if it means closing more plants in Europe. Lacey Plocke is chief economist for the automotive research firm Edmunds. She says it makes sense to follow the money as Chrysler's sales keep climbing.
They did see year-over-year growth for this July, making it the 28th month that they have seen year-over-year growth, which has got to be a record for Chrysler.
Plocke says with Chrysler's strong lineup of redesigned cars, she expects that growth to continue. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We've talked some on the program about genetically modified crops, the pluses and the minuses thereof. Today, though, something a little bit different. Turns out GMO crops are creating headaches for farmers and for the tires on their equipment. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Genetically modified crops are engineered to be tough. It helps them fight off pests, withstand drought, and it's a beefed upness you can see.
The stalks are stiffer and tougher.
Mark Newell is the editor of Farm Show magazine.
So when you cut them off to harvest them, it's like having a field of little spears.
Little spears that are stabbing and bumping and chewing up tractor tires. Poor tires. Robert Parks is the owner of Custom Tire Cutting, which customizes tractor tires. He says this GMO crop stubble is killing tires early.
In some instances, just a year or two, where normally they would get 5 or 6 years out of the tires.
And replacing them is no small thing. We're talking hundreds or thousands of dollars per tire, and tractors with sometimes 8 tires, which means farmers, faced with these tougher stocks, want tougher tires. Parks companies will harden tires for his customers by baking them, but the tire companies are on the job too. Jim Patrico is an editor at Progressive Farmer magazine.
They're doing things like Kevlar lining.
Yep, that Kevlar, the kind soldiers have in their helmets and vests.
So that, again, a corn stalk can't penetrate.
It's a fight out there in the fields. Tires versus thousands of corn stalk spears. Why not turn to the military for a little help? I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders didn't seem to have much care for the Fed's hands-off approach. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was some news this week, the likes of which we haven't really heard much of lately. Two true stories of winning the economic jackpot. One, a scientist. The other, a poker player. First up, the scientist, Alan Guth. He's a physics professor at MIT. He's won $3 million for his work in particle physics, his adaptation of the Big Bang Theory, as he puts it. The money was part of a prize set up by a Russian high-tech investor named Yuri Milner, sort of a counterpoint to the Nobel Prize, except with more money. Professor, it's good to have you on.
Thank you.
First of all, I suppose congratulations are in order, right?
I guess so. Thanks a lot.
How did you find out about this award?
I found out about it initially by a telephone call from one of the other winners. They realized that if Yuri Milner called me up with his Russian accent and told me he would give me $3 million if I gave him my bank account numbers, I'd probably hang up. I was flabbergasted.
How'd you get this money? Did they really just wire it into your account?
That's right. They just wired it into my account. So one day I logged in and suddenly it was $3 million plus.
We should all have such problems, huh?
That's right. That's right. The bank charged a $12 wire fee, but I decided that was okay.
You're okay with that?
Circumstances.
Yeah. What are you going to do with the money, Professor? You figured that out yet?
No. My wife and I have started to talk about it, but we decided that we were both still so shell-shocked that we weren't really in any condition to think about it intelligently.
Do you suppose that smart young high school and college students will see this and say, man, I got to get into physics. There's these prizes out there.
I certainly would not advise any young person to go into physics for the money, yeah. In spite of the fact of these prizes being there. But nonetheless, I think the fact that these prizes are there does, I think, indicate that society values this work. And it's my belief that that does have an effect on young people.
Alan Guth, he's a professor of physics at MIT. Professor, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
To continue with a theme then, some online poker players are expecting a big payout soon, thanks to a settlement between the Department of Justice and two of the world's biggest online poker companies. The companies were accused of running a Ponzi scheme, in essence, using money in players' accounts to pay off others. Fraz Jaka is one of the players that stands to get his money back. Fraz, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this settlement is on the order of a couple of $100 million. What do you suppose your cut's going to be?
I've had a decent amount locked up in there. I don't want to say the exact amount, but it's a six-figure amount.
And you say locked up. I mean, is it stuck on this site?
It's literally been frozen. Can't access it, can't trade it, can't sell it,
wow.
Can't do anything with it.
You play online and real cards as well, right?
Yes.
So which one's more satisfying for you?
Well, to me, the live is more satisfying for me. It's fun. I get to travel. There's more money in it. But realistically, to do this as a career, you need online poker because the sample size is just too small live. You know, you could play 50 to 100 tournaments a year live, but online you could play thousands. I mean, just think about a trader. If you told a trader you could make 100 trades this year, you could be the best trader in the world, but there's no guarantee you're going to make money.
Of course, you know how Wall Street works out sometimes, right? So you do then, don't you?
Not too different from poker.
So now what happens? Are you satisfied you're going to get your money back from Full Tilt?
Well, I tell you what, a lot of my friends are celebrating this week. I'm going to wait till the money hits my bank.
If you get this six-figure sum back, does this then become your biggest win, your biggest payout?
No, it doesn't become my
wow.
biggest payout, but it becomes one of the more emotional
I'm in the wrong
ones.
Line of work. All right, so I have to ask you before I let you go. My producers told me you had an unusual nickname.
My online poker screen name was The Toilet. When I first started playing poker in college, I'd get a bunch of flushes, and you know my roommates and dorm mates would get frustrated and be like, the toilet flushes again.
Faraz Jaka, also known as The Toilet. Faraz, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
I was in Indiana for a couple of days, the end of last week. Did a lot of driving, saw a whole lot of cornfields. But the thing was, a lot of those fields were so dried out and stunted, they could have been wheat fields instead, not green and tall the way you'd expect this time of year. The drought that's hit a huge chunk of the country is doing a number on crops, as you've heard, and consumers are or will soon see rising prices at the supermarket. What's not so easy to see, though, is what that drought is doing to food banks. From San Antonio, Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies has that story.
It looks and sounds like a busy loading dock at the San Antonio Food Bank. Forklifts unload trucks, move pallets piled high with processed food. Summer is actually the busiest time for food banks as they deal with kids missing school lunches. But poke your head in the large walk-in refrigerator and you'll notice there's a shrinking supply of fresh greens and vegetables.
The drought is turning into a bit of a perfect storm in a bad way for us.
Michael Guetta is the chief development officer for the San Antonio Food Bank.
What we're seeing is many farmers struggling. Less water means less produce. Less produce for them means less produce available to go into the donated food pipeline.
Last summer, during the heart of the drought in Texas, produce donations were down 20%, and $170,000 was spent on trucking and fresh veggies. Expect a repeat this summer. If not, folks go home with just rice, beans, and peanut butter.
Good stuff. We know that. But the health implications of not having more produce and fruits and vegetables in their diet is pretty severe.
And finding farmers still growing produce is turning into a tough job.
My name is Francis Country Muchigamba, and I'm the shed manager for the Fresh Produce Program.
Country earned his nickname honestly. He has a bushy gray mustache, a big cowboy hat, and hands calloused and nicked up from a lifetime of working the land. He'll tell you that farming is getting tougher because of the drought, which is in its fifth year in Texas. Country deals directly with the South Texas farmers, and he says they're saving their dwindling water for higher dollar crops like cotton, not so much for vegetables.
Our numbers are starting to diminish on the donated side. We're looking at sourcing from even as far away as Arizona and California, but our transportation costs are extremely prohibitive. It makes our produce extremely expensive.
Up in the Corn Belt, the drought brings more bad news.
The corn and the beans just simply cannot take the nonstop oppressive heat.
Brian Barks of the Food Bank of the Heartland in Omaha, Nebraska, says it's a drought double whammy. Higher food prices squeeze private donations, and another food source is cutting back, Uncle Sam.
At our food bank, approximately 25% of our inventory comes from U.S. Department of Agriculture Commodities Program, and we have seen a significant reduction.
Barks says USDA surplus commodities, staples like peanut butter and corn, will be cut back further as the prices rise. But now, with food bank shelves bare, there is another problem. The drought is an economic downer for America's breadbasket. That will mean less supply and more demand for local food banks, run on shoestring budgets, staffed by volunteers, stocked by donations, and already stretched to the limit. In San Antonio, I'm David Martin Davies for Marketplace.
Coming up, can you spare a buck for small business?
Right now, we probably need about $1 million for the next phase that we're going through.
So more than a buck then. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Fed did nothing today, and Wall Street was disappointed. The Dow Industrial's off 0.25%, 32 points, closed at 12,976. The NASDAQ forfeited 0.67%, 19 points, 29.20 at the bell. The S&P 500 gave back 0.25%, 4 points, finished at 1375. The Fed's decision, though, was nearly eclipsed by other news. A technical glitch in computer trading at Knight Capital sent hundreds of stocks seesawing early in the day. Knight shares lost 32%. More on that right at the close of the broadcast. Financial stocks mostly down. Bank of America off more than 1.5% today. JP Morgan Chase was flat. The maker of Botox, on the other hand, anything but. Allergan plumped up 4.3% after a solid earnings report.
Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.52%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases factory orders for June. Chain stores are scheduled to report sales data for the month of July. And after a long, distinguished career, he recently announced his retirement. Actor Peter O'Toole turns 80. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. American consumers find themselves stuck on the horns of a fairly existential economic dilemma nowadays. Spend more so the economy gets going again. But hey, don't go too far into debt. Our segment this week for Money Matters, about the news affecting our wallets, is the story of a banker who solved her own personal financial crisis by taking a very different kind of job. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports.
Celie Niehaus woke up one day with a spending hangover. She was in her late 20s at the time and in deep, deep credit card debt, $10,000, half her annual income. The hangover was especially brutal for her since she was, well, she was an officer at a bank.
Had been in financial services for many years and knew better and still made the same mistake that many consumers make. Too much consumption, had a little too much fun, got myself in debt, and of course at the end of the day you have to pay it back.
As a banker, Celie was well-versed in the mechanics of paying off debt. Reduce spending, increase revenue. First, she worked on the reduced spending part. Went on a shopping freeze, stopped going out to eat.
I started walking to and from work.
The raising revenue part, that was a little trickier. Her job at the bank was full-time and salaried.
So I couldn't work extra hours at the bank to increase my income, which led me to the second job. I was fortunate enough to know some people that worked for the Fayette County school system, and they had told me about a janitor's job.
She took it. 5 nights a week, 4 hours a night.
I learned a lot about cleaning, believe me.
50 offices every day.
Empty their trash cans, vacuum, get on my hands and knees to clean the table. The glass would need to be fingerprint free. The mopping, that's not an easy job.
Then one day she was rushing back from her banker job in her business suit.
Trying to get home, change my clothes.
When she ran into a woman who worked in the school administration offices she cleaned.
She made eye contact with me.
Celie waved at her, said hello.
She looked at me. There was no recognition. And I said, it's Celie.
Then Celie thinks, oh, right.
You don't recognize me without my garbage can. That's when she realized that I was the janitor.
The woman asked why she was dressed so nicely, and Celie explained the whole situation. By the time she got in for her janitorial shift that evening, everyone who worked in the office seemed to know about her secret life as a banker.
As I went from office space to office space with my garbage can and vacuum, they would start asking me financial services questions, questions about loans, questions about debt. When I left, they gave me a going-away party, and someone had said, they've never given a janitor a going-away party.
It took Celie 2 years to pay off her credit card debt. Today, nearly 20 years later, she's a vice president at E-Trade. In her spare time, she teaches young people about personal finance. She uses this story as a lesson. Looking back, she says, there's no shame in taking a ground-level job to get yourself out of money trouble. She hopes maybe those office workers she met as a janitor learn that lesson, too. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
So you better believe, what with all the heat waves and the dry spells we've been having, that air conditioners are working overtime this summer. But AC is often frowned upon for various and sundry reasons. Daniel Engber writes in defense of conditioned air today in Slate. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So let me question the premise of this piece. Who could possibly be against air conditioning?
You'd be surprised. I know that most homes in America now have air conditioning, something like 87%.
Wow.
But I just find in my daily life that there's a lot of guilt and shame about using the air conditioner. People want to, you know, get by for as long as they can without turning it on.
Now, do you find people in the wintertime trying to go without heat? I mean, does the flip side of this equation work?
No, the flip side of the equation never works. I mean, the very notion is absurd. So there are cafes in my neighborhood where, you know, it'll be 95 degrees out and they don't have the air conditioning on, because why would you, you know, succumb to the temptation of wasteful air conditioning.
The other thing, though, is that people always say, oh, man, you got those chlorofluorocarbons and whatever it is that is in the coolant for the air conditioning, and it's destroying the planet.
Sure. Well, so the big argument against air conditioning now is this idea that, you know, when we turn on the air conditioner, when we try to cool off, we're ironically, I suppose, making the planet warmer. We're contributing to global warming, both through the, you know, guzzling of electricity by the appliance and also by the refrigerant gases that are used.
But you can only get, and this is a little convoluted, you can only get so cool, right? You can only put your feet in a tub of ice and have a fan blow on you, and there's a limit to how much that will cool you off. You can get warm in like a zillion different ways.
Right. Well, you know, there's this sense, well, maybe part one of the reasons we have this sort of thermal double standard, part of that comes from this idea that maybe somehow, you know, cold is worse than hot, that people are going to freeze to death before they catch fire. But, you know, that's just not the case, I don't think. I mean, the data on whether cold snaps or heat waves are more deadly are ambiguous. Certainly both kill lots of people in the United States every year. But for some reason, again, there's this notion that the rules are different on either end of the thermostat.
You kind of tease us at the bottom of this piece, talking about part two that's going to come out tomorrow, about the deeper societal implications of air conditioning in this country in the 21st century. Give us a preview, would you?
Well, I think this goes to the question of sort of the politics of air conditioning, and this is something that the journalist Dan Cox has written about. I mean, he's argued that the invention and spread of air conditioning has really been a boon for the Republican Party because it's created this possibility of southward migration to the Sun Belt. And it's certainly the case. I mean, if you look at the last presidential election, 8 of the 10 hottest states in the country voted for John McCain. And it plays out in even policy discussions. The low-income home energy assistance program favors heating over cooling, and that's been a source of political debate over the years with the warm weather states arguing that more money should be appropriated to them.
Daniel Engber, his piece on air conditioning is in Slate today. It's called Don't Sweat It. Part two comes tomorrow. Daniel, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
There are macro economic stories. The Federal Reserve today and its pledge to stay the course is one. And then there are microeconomic stories, the day-to-day realities of businesses and consumers trying to get by. The Small Business Administration reported not too long ago that lending to those small businesses was down last year. Charlie Mintz explains what that means in practice from a microbrewery in Oakland, California.
At Linden Street Brewery in West Oakland, a red lager is fermenting inside a shiny kettle that looks sort of like a giant silver crayon on its head. Nearby, co-owner Adam Lamoureux surveys a drum-shaped cauldron in need of some scrubbing.
Oh, right now we're cleaning the brew house. Basically, after each brew, we have to clean all the pipes and hoses and obviously the tanks.
So this is the fun part, basically?
Brewing is a whole lot more cleaning than actually making beer.
Lamoureux, 38, is a mellow former Navy engineer with a shaved head and a Rasputin beard dangling over his collar. His wife hates it, but the beard's a charm. It's safe from the razor until the day Linden Street Brewery, which opened in 2009, stops growing.
Every year we grow 200 or 300%.
Linden Street Brewery produces just 2,500 barrels a year. That's 2 kegs to a barrel. And it only has 2 employees. But Lamoureux thinks it can grow. His goal, 20,000 barrels a year and 20 employees. But to get there, he needs a loan.
So right now, we probably need about $1 million for the next phase that we're going through.
And banks, Lamoureux says, don't want to give it to him. In 2009, his community bank, with a guarantee from the Small Business Administration, loaned him $200,000. But since then, the tap's been dry.
We talked to other community banks and commercial banks and then these economic development corporations.
In total, almost a dozen institutions. They all said no.
It gets pretty depressing, really.
So why can't a business like Linden Street get a loan? We asked a banker.
We look at a variety of different factors. There really is no one formula.
Kimberly Hett works for Chase Bank in Oakland. It's not, we should say, one of the banks Lamoureux approached.
We do look at, first and foremost, the business's cash flow. The second piece that we really look at is collateral.
Another factor is debt. Remember that $200,000 loan Linden Street has? In the view of banks, that makes it riskier. But Lamoureux says it's a risk banks ought to be taking.
You know, hey, some entrepreneurs may not make it, you know, but some do.
Het at Chase says her employer is lending plenty to small businesses. Het says Chase this year is on pace to make $20 billion in these kinds of loans, up from the $17 billion it lent out in 2011. The other major banks say their small business loan portfolios are up too.
There has been considerable discussion about whether, in fact, there is a credit crunch underway.
James Wilcox is a professor of economics at Berkeley's Haas School of Business and a former advisor to the Federal Reserve. He says it's clear that credit is tight for small businesses. Less clear, though, whether it's too tight.
Despite the various kinds of data we've got, it's a very difficult proposition to decide whether there's a substantial number of creditworthy businesses who can't get credit on the terms that would seem warranted.
So, are we a nation of Adam Lamoureux's? A survey conducted by the Small Business Majority, an advocacy group, said yeah. It found that 6 out of 10 small companies had experienced difficulty getting credit. Back at Linden Street Brewery, the question is more than academic. Lamoureux says he's going to keep chugging away and hope the banks loosen up. If that doesn't work out, he has a backup plan, a beer bar in China.
I'm halfway joking with people when I tell them I probably would educate the new millionaires of Shanghai on what, like, good beer is all about, and I'd probably be a millionaire by now if I had done that.
Of course, if that were the case, he could lend himself the money. In Oakland, I'm Charlie Mintz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which I'll kick off by mentioning that Facebook lost another 3.8% today. Just shy of $21 is what one share of that company will cost you. I mentioned that, and by implication, Facebook's completely messed up IPO as a way to get to this item about the stock market that I alluded to back in the numbers. The New York Stock Exchange halted trading in 100 or so stocks today after some really crazy volatility began showing up. It brought back memories to a lot of people of the flash crash of a couple of years ago. No 1,000-point drops or anything, but enough when you wrap it in with the glitches around Facebook to remind you that the markets most definitely are not perfect. But who is, right? All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 0.25%, 32 points. The NASDAQ gave back 0.67%, 19 points. The S&P 500 down 0.25%, 4 points. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.